All right, y'all, welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, boy, it's going to be another contest today about who believes things that are more wrong than the other between the left and the right. Who's dumber, liberals or conservatives? It's all just like common denominators canceling each other out. Libertarians are right about everything. Everybody else is wrong about everything. God, it's so annoying. Hey, man, I'll call you right back in about 10 minutes.
The thing of it is, guns. Now, I'm not even a, hardcore gun enthusiast or whatever, but I do have the slightest understanding of reality, liberty. Even if I didn't understand anything about liberty, still, I'm too smart to be for gun control. I can't figure out, I don't know. As silly as some people's religious beliefs seem to me sometimes, the political beliefs of liberals, I think, have got to just take the cake. The ridiculous things that liberals believe. I'll give you an example. Just now, over there at the Talking Points memo, which is Joshua Micah Marshall and his people, and that's, in other words, the Democratic National Committee in quote-unquote journalism form, in blogger form. They just tweeted out this thing. "Be quiet," says Medal of Honor veteran to pro-gun advocate. Ooh, burn. What a compelling argument. But then, if you're brave enough to follow the link over to the Talking Points memo, where liberals write down the things that they think, you find out that the reason he told them to be quiet was because this guy Lott, the pro-gun guy, was talking over him and being rude. And so he said, be quiet. They try to portray it, like it was the exclamation point on his awesome anti-gun argument that he made. Right? Like, oh, so you can just be quiet because I just blew you out of the water. But no, it was just that the right winger was being rude. Well, right wingers are rude. So other than the government employee telling the civilian, retired government employee ordering the civilian around, what else did we learn? Here's the guy's argument. Retired Colonel Jack Jacobs on the MSNBC show yesterday. On Jansing and Company. This is basically a paraphrase of the same stupid arguments going on MSNBC yesterday that we talked about. But, so Lott, the pro-gun guy, is saying, hey, listen, when you ban guns, and there's ultimate gun control on military bases in America, by the way, when you ban guns, the problem is the good soldiers, i.e. anyone who's obeying those laws, they're disarmed. And the killer knows he has the advantage. He's depending upon everyone else to go and abide by the rules and be disarmed, says the pro-gun guy, in this case, the pro-simple common sense guy. And then the liberals' argument is, oh no, if everyone at Fort Hood had been armed, it would have been, quote, an enormous mass fratricide. Really? That's what would have happened. If the U.S. Army soldiers at Fort Hood, who are, by the way, stationed only 100 miles from my door and have been known to burn my neighbors to death. Delta Force Combat Applications Group Team B, April 19th, 1993. Yeah, we remember you guys. According to this Medal of Honor winner, retired Colonel Jack Jacobs, the men and women of Fort Hood are all rabid dogs. If they had guns, they would constantly shoot each other to death all day long. The only thing stopping them is the fact that their superiors have disarmed them. Simple as that, according to him. And just think, goes his thought experiment. If a murderer pulled out a gun and started mass murdering people. I mean, this guy shot at least three people. I don't know if he was going for a record or if, I mean, they're saying he was in a big argument, maybe even a fist fight with the people he shot. So, you know, I don't know exactly what happened there, but anyway, shot three people. That's a lot. Point is, according to these guys, if his victims had been armed and had therefore had the opportunity to return fire to the assailant who was trying to kill them, that would have ended in an enormous mass fratricide, right? I guess because once they killed him, then they would have just gotten the taste of blood on their tongues, and then you can't stop them. And then the shooting wouldn't have stopped until everyone at Fort Hood was dead, according to the experts on MSNBC, according to retired Colonel Jack Jacobs. For the victims to have been able to defend themselves by returning fire would have, I guess no question about it, would have resulted in a, quote, enormous mass fratricide. Yes, the innocent victims, they would have all shot each other, and they would have shot all the innocent bystanders and all the people 6 miles away, and everybody would have died. It would have been, you know, like a green-on-blue attack in Afghanistan. Oh, like happened this morning. When a man, according to MSNBC, yes, I've been watching MSNBC today. A man, according to MSNBC, dressed in a police officer's uniform, shot two Associated Press reporters with his AK-47, killing the photographer. And she's been around and won a Pulitzer Prize and has taken pictures of war zones all over the world. From Gaza to Iraq to Afghanistan, she died this morning at the hands of a man wearing an Afghan police officer's uniform. Right? These people lie, just like George Bush. They want you to go ahead and fill in the blank of what you think they must be trying to say, which is that, in all probability, this was one of them bad guy Talibans who must have stolen a police uniform and must have been posing as a cop when he killed these two, or shot these two women. Right? Boy, you got me, MSNBC. Ha ha ha. Almost. You almost had me believing that, no, this guy wasn't a cop. He was a guy pretending to be a cop. I wonder how long before, well, first, I guess you would have to have any accountability or even the threat of accountability or even bad PR that could ruin one plan or another in America for cops killing people. But as soon as it really starts looking bad, I think we can start looking forward to this. Well, a man dressed in the uniform of an Austin Police Department employee shot a black guy in the back of the head today. You know, which happens sometimes. Well, he was wearing a shirt that seemed to be the shirt of the police. Not that the police gave him the shirt and the gun and the training and the authority to be a cop there that day. Oh no, you might be mistaken to assume that. It would be better to assume he was an imposter, an infiltrator, a man wearing a police uniform, but not necessarily anyone that David Petraeus gave authority to, right?
Nah, couldn't be.
Well, anyway, I just like the intellectual dishonesty. Kind of gets me off. It's a lot of fun for me. And by the way, back to Fort Hood. Yes, I do think that the police and the soldiers should be disarmed. And then they should all be fired, and then they should all have the right to own firearms privately, just like anyone else. So I'm not in favor of soldiers even being soldiers or carrying government weapons around at Fort Hood. They should all have to buy their own. And they should all have to get real jobs like everyone else. Fighting for freedom. Give me a break. Does anybody really think that? On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. NatSummit.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right. Well, I'm a little out of order this morning. On the gun control thing, I saw where liberals, including our friend Steven Zunis on Twitter, he is assuming that, hey, all these soldiers were armed, and the NRA says, well, if everybody's armed, then we'll be safe. Well, what happened here? Actually, there's total gun control on American military bases. It was an MP, one of the only ones who are allowed to carry guns at Fort Hood, a good guy with a gun, quote-unquote, who stopped this guy. She drew on him. And here's a guy who's in the middle of killing people, so what do most cops do in a situation like that? That's right, they run in cowardly terror. But not her. She drew on him, and he apparently put a gun to his head and blew his own brains out. But she's the one who stopped him. Well, she put him in the position to go ahead and stop himself. Good guy with a gun was the one who stopped it. Good guys without guns, three of them died. I forgot how many more were wounded. Less than 10, but still. So, sorry, I know you liberals love believing the things that you believe, but they don't make any sense. It's ridiculous, actually. And by the way, when it comes down to who this guy was and what his problem was, according to people who knew him, he was really upset because when his mother died, they wouldn't let him go to attend her wake. And that was what set him off and set him against the army. Apparently. So goes the mythology so far. I just wanted to point out that, yeah, that's what the army is. And that's what they think of you and your mom. All this crap. And boy, do they load it on thick, too. All the crap about how the army is a brotherhood, and in the army we love each other, and in the army we got your back, and in the army we take care, we fight, we're their family, we blah, 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 lies. Liars. They'll throw you in the garbage. They don't care about you. You need to go and say goodbye to your suddenly dead mom. No. Drop and give me 20, scumbag. Says the U.S. government to its property. So, I'm not saying it was justified what he did or anything, but I'm just saying, you could see how that might have made him feel, you know, if you could imagine being in his position. And you could also see how little it mattered to them. You could see why he might be upset. And I don't know what he went through in Iraq. They say he didn't have to kill anybody. He was a truck driver, but he saw people die. He had bombs go off nearby him. He went through something. Said he had some PTSD.
on TV. It's interesting the way they treat this, right? Well, since he wasn't a Muslim, which is kind of disappointing because they could make a whole thing out of that, you know. What was it that made him snap? Because after all, this is one of our heroes. This is a guy who, by default, and apparently according to everybody who knew him, there's nothing criminal about him. He was a good kid. He's a good guy in every way, said everybody who knew him. But they don't go looking for why everybody else snaps whenever they do anything wrong. You know, when Bales massacres two villages full of civilians in Afghanistan, they go, oh, he snapped. Well, what do you mean he snapped? What does that even mean? Does that even mean anything? Is there a is that definition number 5 of the word snap in the dictionary that I haven't read that far yet? Snap. That means when a government employee commits a horrible crime and TV tries to rationalize it and come up with an excuse. That's what snap means. Wait and see, a drug dealer ordered his soldiers to go out and take out the opposing gang in L.A. last night. Well, you know, he snapped. Because they killed one of his soldiers, or they undercut one of his prices, or... Yeah. Oh, no, but if a cop kills somebody, I mean, assuming they don't just, you know, pretend that he was holding a .38 or whatever, but if they got caught red-handed, well, you know, he snapped. This guy snapped. What caused him to snap? Certainly, they never asked that about Putin, right? Or about Osama bin Laden or some foreign adversary of America, Saddam Hussein. What made Saddam Hussein snap and invade Kuwait? No, he doesn't have reasons. He's so damn insane. It even says so on my t-shirt, dude. No, it's when somebody needs to be blameless, i.e. a government employee does something horrible. That's all of a sudden when we start looking for snaps and reasons for snapping. Funny thing about language that way, you know? All right, did I mention Eric Margolis is going to be on the show to talk about Afghanistan? And Nick Giambruno is going to be on the show to talk about Turkey? And Empty Wheel, the great Marcy Wheeler, is going to be on the show to talk about torture? Yeah, that's true. I wouldn't lie to you about that. Good. ScottHorton.org is my website, by the way, and at Scott Horton Show is my Twitter feed. I quit Facebook. Forget them. Maybe I'll get my plugins updated where it'll automatically push to Facebook or something like that, but other than that, I'm done. Won't do anybody any good anyway, because Facebook won't show my posts to anybody anyway, so. I'm over it like MySpace. I'm over it like my tobacco habit. Okay, now I'm sorry, I just have to bring up the Bush art thing for one moment just to mention how strange it is to me that this guy still doesn't have anyone around him to tell him no. You know, if I was some rich, powerful guy, I don't know, like, say, George Lucas, and I had a bunch of ideas for how I thought things should be, I would make sure to pay somebody to follow me around who disagrees, at least a little bit. Like, hey man, the thing is, we've already got C-3PO in the movie. So we don't really need two C-3POs. And we don't need the second C-3PO to be a ridiculous Daffy Duck cartoon character thing that's 10 times more annoying than C-3PO already is. So, really, you should probably make this character some badass lizard with, you know, razor claws or something like that. I would want someone to tell me, no, dude, you're wrong. If I was George Lucas or Bush. Hey, Mr. President, I'm sorry. I know it makes you feel silly, and I don't mean to embarrass you. I swear to Christ, I'll never tell anyone as long as I live. But we've got to practice how to say Abu Ghraib, okay? We can't have you going out there and saying it 7 different ways every time, having no clue. Because the thing is it's a really important subject. And so it sounds like you don't take it seriously when you can't be bothered to learn how to say it. And you don't even have to get it right. You just have to get it close. But there was no man around George W. Bush ever. Not to teach him how to say Abu Ghraib. Not to teach him that you're overthrowing the minority dictator. And you're going to be stuck with doing pretty much what the majority wants after that. And not to tell him that, hey man, your paintings really suck. And they detract from your already most horrible legacy as one of the worst leaders in the history of Western civilization. And maybe one of the ones who really signed its death warrant, you know, who, or maybe drank the poison is a better metaphor. We already all hate you, George. We already, right now, are thinking this week about all the people in Iraq that you killed on this 11th anniversary. And we're all thinking this week about all the people that you tortured to death. Quite in violation of the law. So that you could try to get them to lie and pretend that they knew Saddam Hussein. Or whatever nonsense. Come up with some orange alert to scare people out of reading too critically about those aluminum tubes you're trying to frighten us with. And so now is really not a good time to come out with these incredibly amateurish and ridiculous paintings. If we can't lock you in prison, we would like at least to forget about you, please. And you know what? Maybe it is that nobody cares about George Bush enough to tell him that. Hey, George, you know me. I love you. You're my cousin or something. But everyone else hates you. So you should probably shut up. You should probably not make fun of yourself at this point. You should probably just let it be. You know? I don't know. Maybe that's what I need. I need people that tell me no, you know, other than my wife. But everybody else. To disagree with me all the time, what I'm doing wrong. I hope I would never do something so terrible as put Daffy Duck in my Star Wars movie. Or invade Iraq or torture anybody to death or release these ridiculous paintings. You'd let me know, right? I guess I can trust you. Okay, good. All right. And then, well, there's a few different things I wanted to complain about. I guess here's what I'll mention now to wrap up the segment before we go to our interviews today. And that is on Oklahoma City. There's a Twitter feed called Fire Tom Friedman. I also hate Tom Friedman. This guy's the most celebrated public intellectual in America. What are you kidding me? And anyway, Fire Tom Friedman mentioned last night that he made friends with an Oklahoma City bombing truther. And I took the opportunity to chime in that, like, hell yeah, of course, man. The only people who aren't 9-11 Oklahoma bombing truthers are damn fools. And then I directed him to the New America Foundation, where they talked about it with Gumbel and Bergen. You can look it up if you want. Good story. Nazis and FBI agents. Dead people. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I got Eric Margolese on the line. He writes at ericmargolese.com, spelled like Margolis. ericmargolese.com, and also at uns.com and at lourockwell.com. Welcome back. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Scott. I'm gearing up to watch this latest Afghan election carnival coming up.
Well, you know, I was reading about that in the Google News earlier, and I thought poor Eric Margolese's got egg all over his face as the American mission, the surge and counterinsurgency mission to create a modern Westphalian democratic nation state there in Afghanistan takes firm hold. And everything you've ever said about Afghanistan over the last decade is proven wrong. So I figured I'd bring you on to make fun of you, you know?
Well, thank you, Scott. There are a lot of people who would like to. You know, one thing that my fellow people in the media will never forgive is when you're right and they're wrong. So a lot of people unhappy with me.
Yeah, well, all right. So now who's running? They got I read some was Robert Dreyfus had a good rundown of the different guys running together, the different running mate groups, and it's one warlord that I've heard of for each pair, and there are five or six pairs, I guess.
It's, this is what's known in Washington as democracy, but I can tell you when I was in Afghanistan during the 1980s and the Soviets were occupying it, they actually ran more democratic elections than we Americans have been running, I'm not proud to say.
Really?
Yeah.
And that's not speaking highly of their process at all, I don't think.
No, it isn't. But at least the Soviets allowed some real opposition parties, whereas the election that will occur on Saturday is just Afghan kabuki directed by the Americans, in that all the candidates have been approved by Washington. Some of them are out of CIA central casting. And the rest are a bunch of drug-dealing warlords, which we should really have nothing to do with, should be ashamed to have dealing with them. And the outcome has been predetermined. I don't know who it's going to be yet, but I can tell you that it's whoever Washington wants it to be.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know, because I seem to remember that the last time they did this back in the fall of 2009, they tried to steal the election from Karzai and give it to Abdullah Abdullah, and they even outed Karzai's brother as a CIA agent and a dope dealer. Not that those two things would ever go together or anything, on the front pages of the New York Times to try to make Karzai look bad, but then Karzai stole the election out from under him anyway, right?
That's correct. They flubbed the effort to rig the election. But
He stole it better than they stole it.
That's exactly right. Karzai is an interesting person. You know, he was a CIA asset. That is, as I said, in CIA central casting, being held in reserve whenever they needed a leader for Afghanistan. You can always tell who the U.S. vetted people are because they speak flawless English, who wear shirts and ties, yeah, and don't have long beards.
Yeah, and I remember. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay. But Karzai, the problem is he's been a disobedient puppet. As time's gone by and he's seen what's happening with the war, he's tried to create a separate identity for himself as an Afghan nationalist rather than as somebody subservient to Washington. And he said, in fact, a while back, he said the only thing that NATO has achieved in Afghanistan is to kill civilians.
Yeah.
And he's doing it now. So he's positioning himself that behind the scenes he'll still wield a lot of influence.
Oh, so you don't think he's just gonna hop on the first Learjet out of town and go live on a hillside in Switzerland somewhere?
He might do that. He might do that too. There are a lot of people who are gunning for him. I wouldn't like to be his life insurer.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, when it comes to Afghan democracy, the person of Hamid Karzai, I like to sometimes just pretend about what it's going to be like, say, you know, I don't know, 50 or 100 years in the future, looking back on the history of this, where, you know, all in the name of democracy from the very beginning, they installed this guy in power. And I remember back from the very get-go on NPR, they were talking about, well, you know, he's just here as the placeholder until the first elections are held. And here he's been in there the whole time. And in 04, the BBC was reporting how his men were going around and threatening these villagers. Vote Karzai or we'll burn your house down. This is, talk about Soviet-style elections. You got one name on the ballot, this guy. And then it was even the American sock puppeteers in charge of him who were complaining about all he does is sit around shooting junk all day. And that's their complaint about him is that he doesn't have enough authority to rule the country. He's not even the mayor of Kabul. He's the mayor of his own damn palace.
Well, that's so because he has been surrounded by American bodyguards for a long time. They wouldn't even trust their own Afghans. There were many plots to kill him. But the whole thing is a sordid snake pit with Karzai and the other so-called Western-backed Afghan politicians. None of them have any credibility except for the warlords from the Uzbek and Tajik North. And at least Karzai is a Pashtun, which is the majority ethnic group in Afghanistan. But the crazy thing with this election, the reason I say it's fraud, I don't even need to know the details. It's a fraud because Taliban and its smaller ally, Hizb-e-Islami, have been banned from the election. And they're, in fact, boycotting it as well. You know, that's like running an election in the U.S. and banning Democrats and saying it's a fair and square election. Yeah. So if they could hold a fair election today, I would be willing to bet that Taliban would probably win.
Or at least
they won't.
Substantially, they would win. They would benefit tremendously, you know, at some level. Anyway, and you know what? Here's how I don't understand. I mean, even if they're not leaving, and I know they don't want to leave, they want whoever wins to sign a new immunity deal and keep at least, I don't know, 20 or 40,000 troops till 2024 or whenever, as long as they can, that kind of thing. But it seems like, hey, if you're going to keep 20 or 40,000 troops there, you're going to have to make a deal. And that was actually the plan all along, right, of the surge was we're going to beat on them real bad for a year and a half. And then we're going to bring them to the table. I know they never really did that. That was supposed to happen in the middle of 11, after all. Here we are still, you know, 3 years after that almost. But it seems like, you know, at some level they recognize, right? Holbrook recognized, all these guys recognize that in order to even stay, never mind declare victory and leave, in order to even stay, they're going to have to compromise with these guys. Now, maybe they don't want to let them win elections, but they're going to have to make some kind of serious concessions to the Taliban at some point, right? Because they're not going to leave themselves with the ability to really wage war against them anymore, it doesn't sound like.
That's exactly right, Scott. The Taliban represent the Pashtuns of southern Afghanistan. They're the majority in the country. And the problem is that the U.S. demonized Taliban from day one. And they're wife beaters and baby burners and God knows what. And they demonized them so much that they excluded the ability to negotiate with them. And now no American politician has the guts to come out and say, we ought to make a deal with Taliban. But you're quite right. They're going to have to, and the Taliban knows it. And I can tell you what's going on right now in Afghanistan, because I saw that in the last days of Soviet occupation, all the Afghans who were working for the Soviets, collaborating with the Soviets, are frantically making side deals with the Mujahideen, and today it will be with Taliban, trying to protect themselves because they fear that when the U.S. withdraws, and particularly when the spigot of the American money is cut off, that the whole rotten apparatus in Kabul will collapse.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, they must be all cutting side deals all along. And speaking of that, by the way, you've mentioned on the show many times how Masoud, who always has, you know, he's the legend in Rambo 3 and all this, what people remember of the, as the leader of the Mujahideen, that he had made a side deal with the Soviets going back I don't know how far.
Absolutely.
And I read a thing just the other day where, was it his son or his brother or somebody like this is now one of these candidates?
That's correct. He's tied up with the Tajik candidate, Abdullah Abdullah, easy name to remember.
Yeah, the
who's actually half Pashtun, too. But he's representing the northern Tajiks, what they call in Afghanistan the Panjshir Valley Mafia. And they are very tied in with Russian intelligence and this Northern Alliance, which we the United States used to help overthrow the Taliban, are the biggest drug dealers in Afghanistan. And not only were they the biggest then, but now they've grown even bigger because the only progress made in Afghanistan is it's increased its exports of drugs under our control.
Mm. And is there an American foreign policy there? That's just a compromise with these guys because they have the ability to maintain some order through their criminal networks and that kind of thing, or what?
They're useful as enemies of the Taliban and the Pashtun.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think American policy is being driven by the military, by the Pentagon. And the Pentagon wants to keep the Tajiks, I'm sorry, and the Uzbeks, led by the major war criminal General Rashid Dostam, who has been much in evidence. He's also involved in the electoral race, wants to keep them as valuable allies. Because during the Soviet occupation, the Uzbeks and the Tajiks, minorities who hate the Pashtuns, collaborated with the Soviet invaders. Then they collaborated with the American invaders. And today, the U.S. is counting on them to sustain the American presence.
Mm-hmm. Well, and... geez, I'm sorry we don't have too much time before we go out to break here, but the Americans in all this time, I mean, other than the fact that Karzai is a Pashtun, have they really done anything to try to help to cultivate some sort of political representation for the Pashtun tribesmen other than the Taliban? Or have they really done anything to try to twist the arms of the Tajiks and the Uzbeks and the Hazars that they've been backing in Kabul in power there to try to make them really compromised? Because it seems like Karzai's the one Pashtun with power in the city, and he's just sort of, it's just ornamental or whatever that he's actually a Pashtun, no?
Well, he has, Karzai has some support, not very broad and certainly not deep, but the Americans have frustrated attempts by Karzai to bring the Taliban into the political process.
Yeah, or, well, all right. We're going to hold that, and we're going to be right back with Eric Margolies. Sorry about these hard breaks. That's just the way it is. We'll be right back in just a sec after this, y'all. EricMargolies.com. Hey, y'all. Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfi, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why Peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Eric Margolies about these bogus elections in Afghanistan, this wonderful democracy the Republicans and Democrats have built over there. And I'm sure you probably saw, Eric, about this Associated Press photographer who was murdered this morning while covering the fake election. Come on, we're going to pass out the ballots to the tribesmen. It'll be a great photo op for the AP. And this lady lost her life reporting on it. And when the whole thing, it might as well be taking place on a stage somewhere, for as real as it all is. I'm sorry. And we can get back to that in just a second. But I wanted to follow up a little bit on that, where we left it hanging was, I guess a better way to put it, is there anything the Americans could have done, I mean, assuming the decade-long occupation here, to try to cultivate any kind of political representation for the Pashtuns other than the Taliban? It seems like as long as you and I've been talking, which is this whole time pretty much, they don't have anybody with any force, with any, you know, actual ability to fight for, you know, literally fight for them other than the Taliban. So it's not that anybody really loves these guys. They're pretty bad guys, but they're not as bad as like Al-Qaeda types, you know, really. And they don't have anywhere else to turn, basically, seems to be the order of the day all these many, many days now.
The United States could have tried to establish some links with the Pashtun people. By the way, a large chunk of the Pashtun people are also on the other side of the border in Pakistan. Right. So they're very, very politically important. But efforts to talk to Taliban, which were started in Qatar and then in Dubai, failed. They were shut down, thwarted by the U.S. efforts by Pakistan to talk to its Taliban insurgents in the tribal territories were also thwarted by the Americans, who killed the Pakistani Taliban leader at the time. So the U.S. has not wanted talks, except talks of more or less, you know, we'll do whatever you say, Bwana, that kind of thing. But they want no recognition of Taliban. They prefer to deal with the Quislings and drug dealers from the Tajiks and the Uzbeks.
Right. And yeah, all I was getting at earlier about the drugs too was, you know, in the 80s, the CIA needed the money, right, for the secret wars in Central America because of the Bolin Amendment and all that. So they had to do the covert drug dealing in order to pay for the covert machete wielding. But in this case, they've got a blank check to do whatever the hell they want. So, I mean, although I guess I can see why their sock puppets still, you know, would like a permission slip to make as much money as they can selling heroin. So that makes sense, you know.
Well, drug money fuels all these warlords. Plus U.S. cash that's handed over in big bags of $100 bills. But the drug trade, drug money, is the only source of commerce and income in Afghanistan. So it's very important.
Yeah. Well, I think we remember from 08, it even broke into USA Today and the New York Times, and everybody else had to admit, I think, at some point there that, boy, you know, all the cash from the global drug black market sure saved a lot of our banks from failure. When we needed a quick injection of funds, we went to our drug cartels and said, please give us some cash. Tens of billions of dollars a year, maybe more than that, right?
Doing what J.P. Morgan used to do.
Yeah, exactly. The Fed's job.
But what I find particularly distressing, I mean, you know, I go way back into the 1980s in Afghanistan and covered two of the wars there, and I was at the birth of Taliban, too. But the American media has learned nothing and continues to give support worthy of the old Soviet media to these current elections. And I haven't seen anybody really questioning the whole process of fake elections any more than the American media questioned fake elections across the Arab world, like in Egypt and Tunisia, and what about Saudi Arabia?
Right. Well, you know, I think maybe part of that is that they're hopeful that the war's going to be over by the end of the year anyway, so who cares if it's on the way out anyway, kind of thing. Of course, the real worry is that, no, they're running an election of fake sock puppets against each other so that whoever wins will sign on the piece of paper that says you can stay. You're invited to stay, please.
Well, I know it's so transparent. It's pathetic You know, the Roman Empire used to keep a stable of kings and monarchs in Rome for whenever they needed to send somebody out to set up a new Roman sphere of influence. They'd send one of these guys out. We're doing the same, but the idea of these guys who have a gun to their heads and whose total income comes from the U.S., that they're going to represent the interests of Afghanistan? Not likely.
You know, I read this thing by Carlotta Gall, the New York Times reporter there in Afghanistan all these years. And, you know, she's done some good work and whatever. I don't want to completely, you know, trash her or whatever. But, you know, it was this long thing. And, of course, it had the accusations about the ISI keeping Osama for whoever, I don't know, themselves, the Saudis, whatever. But then at the end, she really started. It was a pretty long article. Maybe it was the Weekend Magazine or some New York Times Magazine or something. And at the end, it talks about how, well, you know, the project of creating this Westphalian democratic nation state, multi-ethnic nation state in Afghanistan, the project is only half done and really would be a tragedy to call it off now. And I mean, that's as far as their imagination can work, is that, you know, if it hasn't worked yet, it's simply just because it's too early to stop. That's the only thing that they can think of. You know,
that's pathetic. Those kind of attitudes are worthy of babes in Toyland. I'm surprised that a journalist who's been there all these years would say something like that. As someone who knows, you know, the Afghan tribes, they think there's never going to be democracy there. They don't want it. They're not going to do it. All the Pashtun tribes, 60 to 70% of the population, wanted to be left alone and to go and do things the way they've always done, feud and fight and, grow pot and just generally be miserable, be their happy, miserable selves. And they're hillbillies. And they don't want anybody from the outside world. They don't need this phony democracy that we promote because they have their own tribal system, which is much more effective, of loya jirga, as it's called, tribal councils. They have their own. They've been democratic in this sense forever. We're trying to impose a fake Western construct on them. It's not going to work. Hasn't worked. We should really give up, but we're paying just lip service to this. Our real intent is not to promote democracy or women's rights, as it's been falsely claimed, but to keep our military bases there and keep the Chinese out.
Well, do the Chinese even want to come in with anything more than loafers and briefcases anyway? I don't get it.
No. Well, the Chinese are starting to exploit some of Afghanistan's mineral wealth, which is said to be substantial. But the Americans want to keep the military there to overwatch the Caspian oil basins, to keep in play in Central Asia. It's a complicated situation. Unfortunately, we've run out of money to support such grandiose imperial ambitions.
Yeah, fortunately. Well, from their point of view, how come they're picking this fight? They're so concerned with picking this fight with Russia when if they want to pivot to Asia and they want to stay in Afghanistan and do all these things simply to contain China, don't they need Russia's help for that? That's what Dana Rohrabacher said. He was like, don't pick a fight with Putin. I was like, hey, that's pretty good. And he says, we need Putin for going to war with the Chinese with.
He's right. Good old Dana. He's right in this sense. But what's happening in Washington is totally irrationality in the American ruling circles and in the court media. There's bloodlust. We want our wars. We love this kind of thing. And people are thrilled in Washington because suddenly you've got a big enemy coming up again who can justify aircraft carriers and, you know, billions of worth of jet fighters and all kinds of stuff that we couldn't justify with the Afghans. So there's a thrill about it, and it's visceral, and it's childish nationalism that's reasserting itself.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because it seems sort of obvious, but then again, I think most people just really don't get that. But, you know, I'm reminded the way you put that. I'm reminded of the polls where residents of Washington, D.C. think the economy's doing great and everybody else's economic optimism is at the lowest levels in forever, right? But they just they really do live in an entirely different world than us, like kids, right? Like, you could be Donald Rumsfeld and walk down the street and nobody thinks you're crazy because they're all crazy, too.
Well, thank you, George Bush, for that, creating the imperial government in Washington and doubling the size of government and having all these crazies running around the Beltway as national security contractors and stuff like that. It's very frightening, but unfortunately now we are being unsophisticated. A senior Russian said the other day, you know, we should be taking tranquilizers, not getting so whipped up. And I have some Republican friends of mine who say, whoa, we've got to do something about Crimea. I said, turn around and ask your best friends to name three major cities in Crimea.
Yeah, or even one. Come on. All right, we're done here. We got to go. Thanks so much, Eric. Appreciate it.
Cheers, Scott.
Everybody, that's Eric Margolies. He wrote American Raj, Liberation or Domination, and War at the Top of the World. And he writes at ericmargolies.com, uns.com, and lourockwell.com. So go and read him and get smart. We'll be right back. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest is Nick Giambruno. And he writes for The International Man. That's Doug Casey's website. They go traveling the world and writing about things that they know. Advising investors and great stuff like that. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Nick?
I'm doing great, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
Very happy to have you here and happy to see you writing for antiwar.com as well.
Yeah.
This one is called Why Turkey Was Planning a False Flag Operation in Syria. Why indeed? So, okay, well, no, wait. Before the why, first the what. Somebody recorded somebody's phone call and posts online, I hear. Something like that? What?
Yeah, it's something like that. Yeah, and we should go over some context first to understand exactly what this discussion was referring to. But in case some of your listeners or anybody else doesn't know what a false flag is, I often explain it by telling people about this scene in a popular movie. It's Fast Times at Ridgemont High. It's a little bit of an older movie. But in this movie, there is a character who has a little brother, and this character has a very fancy sports car. He plays on the football team. And anyways, one day his little brother takes his sports car out with his friend, and he trashes it on accident, obviously. So they're all freaked out about how the big brother is going to respond since they totaled his car. And they come up with this clever plan to make it look like the rival football team vandalized his car. So they decorate his car with the rival team's logos and colors. And so when his brother finds out about the car, he thinks it's the rival football team that's been messing around with it, not his little brother. And that, in a nutshell, is kind of the essence of what a false flag is. It's where you create an incident, you make it look like somebody else did it, essentially. So why was Turkey thinking about doing something? And, you know, this is usually has nefarious effects in the sense that militaries and intelligence services use this to create pretext for war. One of the most popular instances of a false flag, many people believe, is the Reichstag fire that allowed Hitler to really ramp up his power in the early 30s. So why was, you know, the big question is, why was Turkey plotting something like this in Syria? Now, to understand that, you kind of have to understand a little bit of the dynamics, which I'm sure your listeners do, of the situation in Syria right now. Where Turkey's favored rebels have been faltering, not just recently, but for a while now. And this false flag incident that Turkey was discussing, mind you, these are the most highest-level Turkish officials. This is the foreign minister, and this is the head of the Turkish intelligence, the equivalent of the Turkish CIA, that are discussing this. And they're talking about provoking some sort of attack on this shrine that's located inside Syria. It's actually sovereign Turkish territory within the territory of Syria. It's about 15 or so miles inside Syrian territory. There's this little tiny area that is sovereign Turkish territory. And this territory dates back to the Ottoman times. It's actually a tomb. It's called the Tomb of Süleyman Shah. And he is a relative of one of the founders of the Ottoman Empire. So this goes back a long time. It's not controversial that this is a piece of Turkey that's inside the territory of Syria. It's long been agreed to by the Syrian government. Before that, the French, the colonial rulers of Syria. So this is nothing, you know, new or particularly controversial. So what has happened is this is in the northern part of Syria, and this is a part where government control, the central government of Syria does not control this area, and it has not for many months. And what has happened recently is that you have had the hardcore Islamic State in Syria and the Levant, the ISIL folks, move into the area and threaten the Turkish troops that are stationed there. There's only about 24 or so Turkish troops, so it's not a very large contingent, but they are guarding this little shrine. So you have these hardcore ISIL militants in the area, and they're telling the Turks to pack up and leave, and the Turks have refused. And that's why the Turkish government has gotten a little bit nervous about the situation, since they've refused to leave, and they have these ISIL militants that have basically surrounded the area. Now, on the conversation, they're discussing this. And like I said, this is not controversial. And in fact, even if the Turkish military intervened to protect this shrine, this piece of sovereign Turkish territory inside Syria, I doubt the Syrian government would really care that much at first, because this is an area where, one, they've already lost control, and they have lost control for many months now. Two, they would be fighting the ISIL militants, who would otherwise be fighting the Syrian government. So I don't think the Syrian government would really care about that, and it wouldn't really be controversial, because the Turks are protecting what is internationally agreed upon as their sovereign territory. But that's not the end of the conversation. The really nefarious part is where they discuss using a potential pretext. We should specify who these people are. This is the foreign minister, Davutoğlu, and the head of Turkish intelligence, Hakan Fidan. And they're talking about how they can use this as, quote, an opportunity to protect their troops and their territory, but to use it as kind of a foot in the door to a wider military intervention in Syria, which they would use to help their favored rebels, which have been seeing massive battlefield setbacks and so forth. So, and you also have to understand that the Turkish government, the Erdogan government, has staked a ton of political capital and a lot of its political legitimacy on this whole Syrian uprising enterprise. So since that hasn't really gone the way that they planned it would, they're using this as an opportunity to, you know, they're looking to use this as an opportunity to double down and turn things around. Now, that's kind of a long-winded answer, but that's what happened, you know, in a nutshell, sort of.
Yeah, well, you know, as so often is the case with these things, it doesn't have to sound like these guys are very smart to believe that the story is what it is. You know what I mean? I mean, here they, like you said, they made this bad bet on regime change in Syria back 3 years ago. Oh, yeah, this will be easy. Obama came out and said, oh, yeah, Assad, he better step aside. When, you know, Patrick Coburn was saying on this show back then, man, Assad's regime is not in danger of falling. Not now, not soon. It wasn't at that time, but they had convinced themselves that this was a smart thing to do. And so, okay, they got a perfect pretext, and I'd like you to explain what it was that they were saying, because I think it's kind of funny as false flags go, like how kind of clumsy it is what they're talking about. But using this shrine or protecting, you know, this tiny piece of sovereign Turkish territory in Syria as a foothold to go ahead and cross the border and get in there, it seems like it couldn't be anything but a disaster. You talk about doubling down. Yeah. Doubling down on complete folly. And that's why I believe it so much, right? If they were saying something really clever, I'd be suspicious. But no, this is, yeah, exactly, probably what they think they're going to do. They're going to get in there, and they're going to arm up the Islamic Front, and they're going to, you know, reconstitute the FSA, and they're really going to bring the fight to the al-Nusra Front or to the ISIL or whichever group they are afraid of the most for now. And then maybe they'll get back to work on regime change. And, you know, I guess these intelligence officials and military men, they can sell the politicians on anything, you know? It doesn't matter. It's, again, it's more plausible to me, the more fanciful it is, it's more plausible to me that they believe it and that this is their plan.
Yeah, no, that's true. And it's also, like I mentioned, important to emphasize that the Erdogan government has staked a huge amount of its political capital on this uprising in Syria. And, you know, they just had these elections. I think they're municipal elections, but there are going to be more elections in Turkey. And there are a growing number of Turks who are questioning whether, you know, this whole Syria gambit was worth it. You know, Turkey has been experiencing some blowback. It's not very highly publicized in the news, but there was a shooting, I think, last week by some Syrian militants. I believe it was ISIL. Killed a couple of Turkish cops not in the border area, just like in the middle of of Turkey near Ankara. I think it was south of Ankara. But so Turkey has been experiencing blowback, and the Turkish voters are becoming increasingly skeptical about this policy. So in order to save the future of his political party and his political career, it's really essential for Erdogan to turn things around in Syria from his perspective. But yeah, so here are some quotes.
We're about to have to go out to this break. So I'm sorry, it's a hard break. Going to interrupt us here. When we get back, these quotes. But yeah, I mean, just imagine everybody, Ronald Reagan and the Saudis backing a Mujahideen war right there next to the Mediterranean Sea instead of way safe on the other side of Iran from here kind of thing. You know what I mean? This is ridiculous what they've done. Now the Mujahideen are their enemy? Well, they're the ones who made them in the first place, the Turks and their friends, the Saudis and the Americans. It's crazy.
It is crazy.
It's stupid, and that's why it's so plausible to me. We'll be right back.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. This Sunday on the KPFK show, Anti-War Radio, 90.7 FM, Sunday morning in Los Angeles. I'll be talking with Todd Pierce. He was supposed to be on the show yesterday, but we had phone problems, but... So he's going to do KPFK. We're going to be talking all about the Cheney Doctrine, the Wolfowitz Doctrine, and all of that. Same thing. And also, he was a defense lawyer at Guantanamo Bay, so I'm going to have some Guantanamo questions for him, too. Anyway, right now we're talking with Nick Giambruno, and he writes for the International Man, over there with Doug Casey, and he's got this one at antiwar.com. It's called Why Turkey Was Planning a False Flag Operation in Syria. And by the way, Nick, well, you say whatever you want as far as where we left off, but also if you could actually tell the story of what's in the transcript, not necessarily word for word, but, you know, go ahead and paint the picture of what this phone call really revealed, and then that way it makes it better for the Turkish government's response when the call was leaked.
Oh, yeah, well, the Turkish government response was to try to ban YouTube and Twitter, which, of course, is an obsolete response. You can't really ban YouTube and Twitter anymore with people who have VPNs and so forth. So it was really kind of a childish fit, in my opinion, rather than any sort of serious response. But anyways, here are a couple of the most damning quotes from this conversation. Now, I should, you know, tell you up front, I don't speak Turkish, but I did find these translations in the international media and multiple sources, so I believe them to be accurate. So first you have the foreign minister, Davutoğlu, says that Erdogan, the prime minister, believes that any attack on this shrine should be viewed as, quote, an opportunity. And then you have Hakan Fidan, who is the head of Turkish intelligence, says, in quote, I'll send four men from Syria if that's what it takes. I'll make up a cause of war by ordering a missile attack on Turkey. We can also prepare an attack on the Suleiman Shah tomb if necessary. Now, those are, unquote, those are the two really most damning quotes out of the whole transcript. And if your readers want to look, you can easily find it. Just, you know, you just Google Turkish leak, telephone leak, and it'll come up. Now, like I said, I don't speak Turkish, so I don't know 100% for sure if those translations are accurate, but I did see it in multiple mainstream international media outlets, so I'm pretty sure they are. But I have heard from Sibel Edmonds, who is a very smart woman, and of course, you know, she's Turk. She's a native Turk. She speaks Turkish and understands the situation well. She says that it's possible that the tapes have been spliced together and have been taken out of context, which is, you know, obviously another possibility, but it's pretty hard to see how just those two quotes that I gave you could be taken in any other context than Turks are looking to use this as an opportunity to double down on an already failed policy.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I just like this whole political world shaping up where everybody's leaking each other's phone calls. You know, the people in power, as has been the trend in Eastern Europe lately and all that kind of thing. I wish that, you know, the Russians would publish everything they got on every Western power and vice versa, too. Go ahead. You know, let's see the war of the recorded phone calls. And then, you know what? If people want to complain, no, you took us out of context and here's the real version and all that. You know, what a brave new world. I would love to see it. It looks like it's already shaping up that way, so. You know,
yeah, it does, and I think the Russians. I can't say 100% for sure. I'm 100% certain on this, but it does look like the Russians could have done this. You know, given what they did in Ukraine with their those two other, you know, really dramatic leaks that they presumably published, and then this one coming right before the Turkish elections. And in any case, if this was taken out of context, I think there is a benefit to leaking this because it really takes the wind out of the sails of using this as a strategy in the future. So if the Turks are looking for a pretext to get into Syria, they better, you know, think of a different excuse than this.
Right. Well, and you know, like we're saying, well, yeah, I was saying, I think you're agreeing that it would be absolutely stupid for the Turks. I mean, what are they going to do? How many troops are they going to put in there? And then they're going to supply them for how long? How far into Syrian territory is this place anyway?
Oh, it's about 15 to 20 miles. But
that ain't
scary
that far,
part is no, it's not, but it's a foot in the door, and Turkey is NATO. So that's the real scary part. It's not just Turkey. When Turkey gets involved, then you got all of NATO involved, and that's a game changer. So that's the real worrisome point here.
Well, and the other thing is about the Turks, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Americans attempting, and I don't know exactly which all sheikhs from the Gulf are sending, you know, Western Union to which all jihadis on the front over there or whatever. I don't know if anybody really has all that sorted out, but they keep seeming to talk like, wow, you know, we sure do like the Free Syrian Army of expats that sits on the Turkish side of the border and does nothing all day. And we sure are terrified of the actual Mujahideen who are out there doing the fighting and the killing and the dying in this war against Assad. Because the ones who are the volunteers out there fighting, I mean, it's not like they're in a state professional army following the orders of officers or whatever. They're all basically volunteers out there. And the only ones who are the ones who are not controllable because, you know, they're so determined to you know, by definition, they're the extremists who are not going to do what they're told later. And so, but this is the game they've been playing for 3 years straight. You know, it's like the Israelis shooting and crying or something. Oh, no, look, everybody, we're accidentally backing and funding a bunch of prisoner beheading suicide bombers in Syria.
Yeah, well, a couple of things there. Yeah, no, I think that's totally true. It's been a losing bet for Turkey and the Saudis and the Americans for, you know, the past 3 years, and it's a tragedy. Also, yeah, the main power on the ground, is the Free Syrian Army is essentially irrelevant now. The real power on the ground are these Salafi Islamist militant groups, of which only one is really acceptable, sort of, to Western powers, and that's this Islamic Front. And really, the Islamic Front coordinates a lot of their activities with the Nusra Front. And the Nusra Front, as you and your listeners know, is the official al-Qaeda franchise in Syria. It's been blessed by Ayman al-Zawahiri. So it's really the distinction between the Nusra Front and the Islamic Front, I think, is imaginary. I think they just use this fake distinction to make the Islamic Front, you know, it's kind of like window dressing. So they can point to this group and say, hey, it's not al-Qaeda. It's a mainstream group that we can support. When really on the ground, there is no difference.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure you probably saw, did you see that Patrick Coburn five-part series on the new rise of the next generation of al-Qaeda?
I saw part of it. Yeah, it was very good.
Yeah, and you know, of course, this is really what he chalks it up to, of course, is the war in Iraq. And then with the American, you know, with this chapter of it, the American / Saudi support for the jihad in Syria all this time, this is what's really reignited the Iraq war, because it's got the Mujahideen of the Sunni areas of Iraq looking at it like, well, hey, forget these borders. If you do forget these borders, look, we're the majority in the region. Why should we let the Shiite Arabs backed by Iran have Baghdad and tell us what to do? And so, even though they just lost the civil war over there just, you know, 5-6 years ago, they got the idea that, you know what, we are pretty good at fighting. Let's go back to war.
Yeah, no, that's true. And you mentioned earlier about how, you know, Israel is supporting this to kind of take Iran down a notch on the strategic level. And this is a clear instance, in my opinion, where Israeli and American interests clearly are divergent. You have the Israelis who see this as supporting the jihadis as a tactical threat versus Iran, which is a strategic threat. So they're favoring a tactical nuisance over a strategic problem. And, you know, if that's understandable from anybody, that anybody would prefer to have a tactical problem than a strategic problem. But for the Americans, it's the other way around. It's where al-Qaeda is the strategic problem. So really you have the situation where clearly the interests are not aligned there.
Yeah, and you know, in fact, Michael Oren, who's now, is it CNN has hired him? Yeah, CNN has hired him to be, you know, a foreign policy analyst there. He was the last Israeli ambassador to America, and he was just explaining that, oh yeah, of course I prefer these bad guys to those bad guys. Those bad guys being Hezbollah, because those bad guys are backed by Iran. And so for him, he's like, what, are you kidding me? Of course we prefer, and he doesn't outright say Zawahiri's men, but that's who he's talking about. And you're saying, that makes perfect sense if you're the Israeli ambassador, but not if you're an American, you know?
Precisely.
They didn't knock down towers and kill 3,000 Israelis. Those were Americans who died in that al-Qaeda attack.
Yeah, precisely. So from the Israeli perspective, al-Qaeda is a tactical nuisance. Iran is a strategic problem for them. And it's the reverse for the U.S. So it's clearly, you know, an area where the views are divergent. So that's why they would. And, yeah, Michael Oren is the guy who really enunciated this. in public. So that is, I think you can that's an issue where you can point to a clear-cut divergence of interest. And it's not just a minor issue. It's a huge issue.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I should say, too, that the president himself really, in his conversation before last, I guess, with Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic, they talked about, Goldberg asked him what more can be done in Syria, and he said, well, you know, there are things that we're doing, and I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you, ha-ha, wink-wink, whatever, and they agree that this would be a good way to weaken Iran a little bit by taking their friend Syria down a peg, and there's no pretense for a minute that, save the people, or whatever. They don't even pretend that they care about the weak at all. It's simply, as a strategic matter, why support the Mujahideen in Syria? The president agrees with Goldberg, because it helps weaken Iran, so... It's divergent to you and me and the national interest, but not to the President of the United States and his government's interest, apparently.
Yeah, well, that's unfortunate that he's seeing things so not clearly, in the sense that thinking that supporting these guys, the rebels, is somehow in the U.S. strategic interest, when it's, you know, these are essentially al-Qaeda-connected mm-hmm. folks.
Well, and of course, he's been really at the forefront of leaking that, I don't want to back the Mujahideen in Syria. No, I'm against it. Hillary wants to back the Mujahideen in Syria, but I'm reluctant, says the president, whatever. Meanwhile, he's shipping them guns the whole time. Meanwhile, his CIA is helping the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks coordinate all their support across the Turkish border and on and on. This is for years now. You know, it's ridiculous. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And it's treason. Because, as you were saying, these guys are sworn loyal to Ayman al-Zawahiri, and that makes them the enemy, even officially and legally, you know?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting point.
And now, it's not that Obama's a secret Muslim in Zawahiri's employ. Obama thinks Zawahiri and his men are their useful idiots this time, but who's zooming who, you know? Does anybody think the Americans or the French or any of our friends are going to end up really controlling the future of Syria? I don't. I think it's going to be like this for decades.
Yeah, no, and I think that's kind of the point, too, is that the Israelis would prefer to have a tactical problem than a strategic problem, and that's why they'd rather have a fragmented, disorganized state than one that's united and has the backing of a strong regional power.
Right. You know what?
But
I just realized I'm over time, and we've got to go. Thanks, Nick, very much. I appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks, Scott.
That's Nick Giambruno, everybody. He's at the International Man over there with Doug Casey. And you can read him at antiwar.com, too. Why Turkey was planning a false flag operation in Syria. We'll be right back with Empty Wheel in just a sec. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good. Investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. You can see why I named it that. Website is ScottHorton.org, again, with the name thing. you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. And our next guest on the show today is Marcy Wheeler, the great Empty Wheel, as they call her online, emptywheel.net, and on Twitter as well. Welcome back. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Yourself?
I'm doing good. Oh, yeah, I should mention also that you're something or other over there at The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald's project with First Look Media and all that.
Still getting off the ground, yes.
That's cool. Very cool. All right. Very lucky for them. There's lots of wheeling and dealing in D.C. over the release of the torture report. And I guess the Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein's committee, has voted to release the summary of the report. But I guess, you know what, I probably can't even get that far without getting it wrong. So why don't you straighten us out on what's going on here?
No, that's right. They voted to release the executive summary, the findings, which include things like CIA lied to Congress, and then the additional and dissenting views. And what you saw at the end was three people who are opposed to the report voting to release the report, people like Saxby Chambliss and I keep thinking Aaron Burr and Richard Burr, his descendant. They voted to release it because so that they could include their dissenting views so that they can beat up on the report.
Mm-hmm. And I guess because they were going to lose anyway, right? And so they had to vote for it to include their part of it. Is that it?
Yeah. Susan Collins was the ninth vote to release it. She's Angus King, who's independent but caucuses with the Democrats, voted yes. But once they had Collins as a Republican voting yes, I think it made it more attractive for people like Chambliss and Burr to come along. Collins says she has her reservations about how the report was done, but everyone, all of a sudden, this is actually breaking news. Collins, even Tom Coburn, have both called this torture this week. So now all of a sudden it's okay to use the word torture in D.C. unless you're a big media outlet, in which case you still use techniques or harsh or what have you.
Right. Enhanced. I like that.
Harsh.
We
just harshed Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 183 times.
Well, and you know, I always kind of resent all the focusing on the waterboarding because that by definition excludes most of the people who were tortured, and that's even by the CIA. Correct me if I go off the story. My best understanding, and I'm not Scott Horton, the international human rights lawyer. I'm just a lowly old, you know, Scott Horton, the radio show host guy. My understanding is, yeah, so the CIA tortured 100 and something people and murdered a handful of them, and the military tortured tens of thousands of people in Iraq and Afghanistan and at Guantanamo Bay and murdered nobody even is counting how many people. Is that about right?
Yeah. I mean,
and everybody goes, oh, you know what? They only waterboarded three of the worst guys. You know, Ramzi Bin al-Shib, who gives a damn what happens to that guy, you know?
Right. One of the interesting things that came out this week in McClatchy, which has had, they've had good reporting on this, is that the report also finds that something like 29 of the detainees that were in CIA custody were in their custody illegally, which I suspect means everything from Khalid al-Masri, who the German immigrant who we picked up and tortured for a number of months and then dumped naked, you know, just dumped him in Kosovo. And then it probably includes people that we rendered from Iraq illegally because we were an occupying force and we're not allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows what else, but there's, you know, almost 30 people that we detained completely illegally.
Yeah, we, meaning the CIA, which I don't know how long you've been working there, but I don't.
They're not paying me, that's for darn sure.
Yeah, well, you probably owe them for the lousy job you've been doing of covering their ass, I gotta tell you. Tell me what it is that you actually have learned so far. Anything really new to you here?
From the buzz leading up to the report? You know, not really. I'm a pessimist. I know a lot of human rights defenders are really optimistic about this report. The kind of punchline of the vote to release the report is that the CIA, whom the report accuses of lying repeatedly, of mm-hmm. making stuff up, they get to decide what to declassify or not. So, right, you know, it's just like, what are they going to give us? So there are a few details, like I said, the McClatchy reported, which are new, such as the illegal detainees. But a lot of it, frankly, you know, that the CIA lied to Congress repeatedly has been in the public record starting since 2009. You know, they there are briefings from those. There are notes from those briefings, which, you know, make it very clear they oversold how useful the intelligence from Abu Zubaydah was. They lied about where it came from. They lied about how many lives they had saved. They lied about what they were doing to him. They lied about the tapes they had made of his torture. They lied about what the review, you know, it's just a long list that we already know. I suspect we'll learn when the actual report comes out more about the 2004 to 2005 time period, because there's a whole nother set of lies that we know less about. So that's something I'm looking forward to, but that hasn't leaked to the press yet.
Right. I mean, this is what's got my hopes up, is that at some point it's because of that number 6,300. Like, wow, that sounds like a really thick book about torture by some Senate staffers with some access to some documents the rest of us have never seen before. Can't wait till Marcy writes up her blog entry on that thing. You know what I mean? That's what I want to read, is what you've got to say about that whole thing. But just the summary, I don't know. Maybe if it may just help normalize the torture more, that, okay, well, at least we admitted it. Now we've reckoned with it, and now we can move forward.
Well, and, you know, here's what else is going to happen is, A, John Brennan, who only gets named a few times in the torture report, but nevertheless was pretty closely associated with it, he gets to decide what we get to see, which means he gets to control the timing of it. And the Republicans on the committee, especially, I keep thinking Aaron Burr, but it's Richard Burr, they've already sort of targeted Mark Udall. They sort of want to make this into an election year issue for him. He's up for re-election in Colorado. He's been very good on this and on NSA. And so, they're sort of where I see this going is precisely where everything went in 2009, when Nancy Pelosi made kind of a gentle critique and they spent 6 months claiming she had been briefed on stuff she hadn't been briefed on, which is not to defend the fact that she didn't do more to end torture, but the CIA and the Republicans on the committee, I think, are just better at working the press than most of the Democrats have been, and therefore it's just going to be another big PR battle for the entire summer about what the torture report actually says. And given the experience, we know that, for example, John Rizzo and Jose Rodriguez have had pretty unlimited ability to speak to the press about what went on in the torture program. And you compare that with Ali Soufan, who was the FBI officer who was involved in the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah. And they completely gutted his book. Mm-hmm. Same topic, should be subjected to the same rules of declassification, and yet his weren't. Same with Glenn Carl, who was an interrogator, but his book, big gaping holes in it because of the censors. So, it's not going to be a fair debate. And I also think the Democrats aren't prepping for the kind of debate that we're going to see. So it's going to be ugly, nasty partisanship for most of the summer on this.
Mm. Have any of the stories so far talked about Iraq and the role of trying to beat the name Saddam out of these guys?
The program and how? Not about the report itself, but we know that they look at individual detainees, and at least in 2009, there were hints that included even Sheikh Alibi, who's the worst case of that, right?
Right.
Even Sheikh Alibi, yeah, under torture, said that Al-Qaeda had gone to Iraq to develop chemical weapons, vice versa. In other words, said not only that Al-Qaeda and Iraq had ties, but also that they kind of tied it in WMD, so it was like a trifecta. That was used in Colin Powell's UN speech, which was what persuaded a lot of people on the fence. And the guy retracted it, I think actually retracted it before even it was used in the UN speech. Once he got into U.S. rather than Egyptian custody, he retracted that claim. So there are cases like that, and there are cases where and again, this stuff is in the public, much of it is in the public record. What I'm really curious about is, for example, Hassan Gül, who was captured in 2004 by Kurds and started talking immediately and gave up the courier that eventually led to Osama bin Laden. And then we wanted more information out of him, and I think also we, being the Bush administration, wanted to gin up election year fever, and so said we have to keep torturing him for more information. Mm-hmm. And his case is one of the ones that the CIA lied about to DOJ to get approvals for. I can say that with pretty high degree of confidence. And so that's one case I'm really looking forward to, partly because he was so central in the hunt for Osama bin Laden, but also, you know, we captured him. He was kind of doing the initial reach between al-Qaeda and Musawi in Iraq, and therefore the initial outreach that actually did lead to al-Qaeda being in Iraq because we caused a war there. I think that the details on his torture would be rather interesting. And the timing, especially, I suspect that CIA lied to DOJ about when they tortured him and where, because it wasn't necessarily legal for them to take him out of the country. Lots of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. By the way, just now when you said Musawi, did you mean to say Zarqawi?
About
link between Saddam and Osama?
See, you correcting me now. Thank you.
Yeah. No, well, hey, I screw up all the time. Yeah, I'm just trying to be helpful. I thought, because I wasn't sure if Musawi, I know him and his brother, there's a whole bunch of things to say about him, but that's different. But no, the fake Saddam al-Qaeda link, as Zarqawi was definitely, other than the al-Libi lies, you're saying it was this guy, Gul, was who they tortured into claiming that Zarqawi was buds with Saddam and Osama, is that right?
Yeah, I remember that letter that came out in 2004, he was the one carrying it, and there were questions at the time about its provenance, but...
Right. And then we found out later that he had already told Osama, no, I want to fight the king of Jordan, not fight with you against the Americans, I don't care about them, and Saddam had a death mark on his head, and orders to the... Not just a bolo, but a APB, all points bulletin. If you find this guy, kneecap him. And meanwhile, the Weekly Standard and all the neocons were pushing all these lies about how Saddam had given him a peg leg. Remember that?
Yeah.
The peg leg terrorist. That's how you know somebody's lying.
If I'm going to get the name wrong again, but I think Benatash actually does have a fake leg. Kind of made it especially hard for him to be, you know, hung by his arm. But it happened.
It wasn't Saddam that gave it to him, was it?
No. It was probably CIA money.
Yeah.
Wandered through the IFI, right?
Yeah, at some point anyway along the chain. It all comes back to the central bank, doesn't it?
Exactly.
It's the reserve currency of the world. All right. Well, let me see here. Oh, I know. I wanted to ask you about the people who believed them. Do you think that it matters that this Senate report, and I'm sorry because I know your beaten path is really the little details, but, you know, also just think back to how many people took on all the talking points in defense of the torture regime. I mean, the Bush administration and Roger Ailes and whatever co-conspirators with them, they really normalized torture in American society, where this isn't a thing that a barbarian does. This isn't a thing that a bad guy does in a movie. This is the thing that your heroes do now. And, you know, people really internalize this truth. And so then I wonder if you think that now they're going to be mad that, hey, I used those talking points fighting with my family in favor of torture, and now you're telling me that it was really all for naught? Because you have a pretty, you know, extensive list of lies that they told to Congress, that they told to the people here about what was going on.
You're going to see a range of that. I think, as I said, Coburn actually admitted that some of this could be, it was a very hedged comment, but he did say that, well, it could be considered torture. Mm. That's fairly big, because he's pretty uncritical of the CIA in his position on the Intelligence Committee. But I think that, you know, the people close to Cheney, they're going to double down. John Rizzo going to double down. Jose Rodriguez, they're going to double down. And the reason they can do that is because the press is not going to hold them to account, because CIA is going to prevent the press from figuring out where the details are, where they can, I'm very confident in saying it has been for 4 or 5 years that CIA lied to Congress, because CIA's own documents make that crystal clear. But I'm one of maybe three people in the press who's actually gone into those documents and looked at them in that kind of detail. And therefore, you know, the press will go, well, you know, Nancy Pelosi told me one thing and Porter Goss told me the same thing, but I haven't actually looked at it that closely because I'm instead listening to what Pete Hoekstra said, Porter Goss said. And, you know, I mean, that's what happened the last time. And I do think that the people who really stake their reputation on torture aren't going to back down because they, you know, partly they can't legally, partly they can't, you know, Cheney should go down as a war criminal, but he's going to do what he can to avoid getting that reputation, at least while he's still alive. Right. And I think the other, I mean, here's the other really important thing is people listen to the way this debate goes out. You always hear torture doesn't work. And the assumption when you hear that comment is that torture is intended to find intelligence.
Right.
And even some of the documents that have already been declassified make it crystal clear that torture was meant to exploit detainees, which can mean get intelligence from them, but can also mean, as you said, get false confessions. Get somebody to say that Saddam and al-Qaeda were building chemical weapons together, as happened with Ibn Sheikh al-Libi. And then a third use is to recruit informants, recruit people to flip and go back into al-Qaeda. And there's been some details of Penny Lane at Gitmo about this. There are other public details that I think, you know, it's not something I've really tried to pursue, but, you know, they're sitting out there in plain sight of these people that we tortured and got them under torture to at least claim that they were going to flip for us. And so it's, you know, I guess what I'm saying is people should think of this as exploitation. And that's a technical term, but it means that range of things, actual intelligence, fake intelligence, flipping, getting them to do, you know, propaganda for us. All of those are the purpose of torture. And for that purpose, torture works great. And the people who are going to defend torture till they're blue in the face, they're the ones who wanted it not because it gave them intelligence, but because it gave them the ability to exploit these detainees.
Right. And it really goes back to the first premise. You can look at it when these psychologists are talking about learned helplessness. If you torture a dog and at random all the time where there's no way the dog can even figure out any way to try to resist or avoid it at all, at some point they just completely break down and become putty in your hands to whatever degree. And I guess these psychologists like to torture dogs all day to find out these things. But anyway, they said, so that's what we'll do to these people. We'll teach them learned helplessness. We will completely break not just their human spirit, but their mammalian spirit to even try to, you know, persevere at all. It doesn't sound like they wanted the truth out of these guys. I think people might picture Kiefer Sutherland going, you know, I punched you in the ribs twice, and I'm going to punch you three more times if you don't talk. They don't imagine putting people through a regime of what kind of Nazi insanity for weeks in order to drive them mad, to drive them out of their humanity so that they become helpless. If that even works, you know, I'm sure they tried.
Right. And I'm sure part of it's just ego. You know, we're the United States. We must make everyone submit. And all the better if we can make Khalid Sheikh Mohammed submit. It's not, you know, he's running us ragged down in Gitmo at that kangaroo trial that we've got, rather than bringing him to New York and putting, you know, quick, easy trial done, go to jail for the rest of your life. Instead, we've got to have the kangaroo court, which actually serves his purposes.
Oh, man. And you know what? You couldn't say it better either. When he's gotten the judge to rule down there, he gets to wear a camouflage hunting jacket to court like he's a general in some war instead of some low-life thug scumbag criminal who, like you said, any judge would have locked him up and thrown away the key years ago.
Right.
It's amazing. I don't know how the hell they got away with that. Seriously, they're letting him wear camouflage to court. I mean, I guess that does serve the empire's purpose too, right? It always has, to pretend that al-Qaeda is some giant Islamo-fascist caliphate rather than just a band of pirates on the run somewhere, you know?
Yep.
Well, yep. And also, you know, when you talked about the uses of torture, and you mentioned this too, I forgot your exact wording that you used, but you referred to just all the scares that came out of the torture, too, from this guy Gaul. And I know a lot of them came from Zabeda, too. Oh, they're going to bomb a bank in New York or New Jersey somewhere at some point. Call out the SWAT teams to patrol out front of all the banks. I remember driving, I'll never forget this one, the top of the hour AM radio out of San Antonio in 2002, or maybe it could have been 2003, right before the invasion of Iraq. Be on the lookout. There's an Al-Qaeda terrorist threat against a school in Texas. Somewhere. Good
right,
luck
and,
out there.
And,
you know,
I,
and there's like 75,000 schools in Texas, right? Like, you couldn't count them all. It's ridiculous.
Right. And one of the other remaining big lies to DOJ that we know got told was one of the detainees, a bunch of detainees were arrested in Pakistan leading up to the 2004 election. And starting as early as July and you know, July 1st, they were like, oh, election year, election year, election year, election year. And the basis for that actually was this guy who had come and scoped out the United States in like 1999. I'm going to get the year wrong, but something like 1999, gone back to the UK and done nothing with it, except that his documents for scoping out the United States had gotten into a database in Pakistan. And that was the basis of the election year scare. But then they kept detaining all these guys and to get them to invent some kind of election year scare, because you need an election year scare. And one of those guys is another one of the detainees that DOJ, that CIA lied to DOJ most egregiously about. So, you know, that's another one I'm really looking towards, because it's this case where they needed a scare and went and beat some detainees and got the scare. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, used the initial parts of the scare as justification to roll out the phone dragnet at the court level.
Mm-hmm.
Roll out the internet dragnet at the court level. They went to the judge and they said, oh, scary, scary, scary. And so she approved it. And some of that stuff goes back to torture. So, you know, torture led us into the dragnet too.
Which she would have done it anyway, probably, but still. No, important point. And you know what I wonder now, too? There's been, Trevor Aronson is the best on this from Mother Jones in his great book, Terror Incorporated, about the FBI and the at least 50 outright entrapment cases. Now, there have been hundreds of bogus terrorism charges and terrorism convictions in America, guilty pleas and who knows what, too. But there have been 50 that are pretty much, you can tell, outright entrapments. And he does a brilliant job of explaining how at the FBI, all the incentives are to keep doing this and never to stop doing this. If they can trick some idiot into saying he loves Osama and they can make a terrorism case out of it, brilliant. But it's got me wondering, this conversation, whether Karl Rove invented this thing and whether somewhere there's memos that say, hey, listen, go and find retarded kids at Islamic bookstores and get them to say something stupid. We need cases. We can only torture Zabeda so much into making up nonsense about malls under threats. We need people to parade on TV, so go and get us some. You know what? Isn't that suspicious? Like, maybe this began at the top. Obviously, it's one of them self-licking ice cream cones where every FBI agent in America now wants to make his stripes by entrapping some idiot. But I wonder if that's really, you know, where it started, if there's a chicken-egg thing there.
I don't even think you need to go there because, you know, it's kind of like the logic of bureaucracy. You tell people that they get promotions if they go and trap 19-year-old kids. And that's what they're going to do. And that's what's happened. I mean, I think I think Trevor's work, Trevor Aronson, as you said, is really great on that. And I think his work is really instructive when you compare it to what happened to Jahar Tsarnaev, to the Boston, attackers, because many of those kids who get entrapped are picked up because they read Inspire, the AQAPU magazine. And we know, or at least the government claims in the Boston Marathon case, that the younger brother figured out how to make a pressure cooker bomb from reading Inspire. So how come he didn't get the same entrapment treatment as all of these kids around the country?
Yeah. Well, now, have you written that up, your masterpiece on Boston yet, or what? Because that sounds like a whole other interview or two there, Marcy.
I've written some of it up.
All right. Well, we're going to have to catch up on that here soon. That's the great Marcy Wheeler, emptywheel.net, everybody. Thanks, Marcy.
Take care, Scott.
All right. See y'all around.